Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:15 now on this Tuesday morning. Well, the Summit County Council meets tomorrow starting at 4:30 at the County Courthouse in Colville. In the studio with a preview, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the council will look at possibly forming a Kimball Junction Blue Ribbon Committee for a preliminary master plan. Do we really have anything left out at Kimball Junction, the master plan?
Well, I think we're now in the phase of some of the folks out in the area that own property or are running commercial areas out in the area that are interested in what is next. If property redevelops, what is it going to look like? We're trying, I think that group of folks out there is trying to get ahead of it a little bit and figure out as a group what with the community and with the county government, what could that look like in the future?
Yeah, so one of the major topics would be transit and how we work.
Absolutely.
That.
I mean, it includes everything. So how would transit incorporate into that area? What would parking look like around transit and around commercial businesses? You know, as the Boyer Tech Park develops out, what's it going to contribute to the overall neighborhood? One of our major things that we're working on this year is affordable housing, and how will that figure into the whole mix of the future Kimball Junction as it develops over the next 30 to 40 years.
So who generated the idea? Was it the planning staff? Was it the property owners out
there?
Well,
it came out of the master plan or the master plan for the area for the Snyderville Basin, where it talked about doing these neighborhood plans once the code was finished. But really, the property owners came together and started talking to us about those possibilities and what is next. And then the planning staff talked to those folks in a group for a little while and then brought it forth to the council to talk further about.
Okay. Also on the agenda, a discussion and possible adoption of the Summit County Fairgrounds Master Plan. This would be a plan for up to 15 years, and we're talking about how much money?
Well, it projects the improvements that would need to be made in order to function for the fair. So over a 15-year period, we already know that the Quonset hut or the main building on the property needs to be replaced. It's reached its useful life, probably beyond its useful life. Some of the animal facilities that are used by the 4-H groups during the fair, one of the more successful parts of the fair, which is the 4-H animal auction, those facilities are also aged out. What isn't aged out yet is probably our rodeo facility. In order to phase this over several years, we master plan the whole property, but we're not planning on we're not recommending that we attack the whole property at one time and build everything at once, because we don't need to.
Right. So is that what we're talking about for the first phase in that Quonset hut and livestock stalls?
That is what the recommendation is, in order to improve those facilities first. Probably also one of the things that needs to be done is improve some of the underground utilities that are on the property, especially electric. Right now, we run a lot of electrical cords around the property for the fair and for other large events. And we'd like to improve that so that it's a little safer.
Okay, so that could start as soon as the end of this year's fair and hopefully be done before next year's.
Absolutely. And, we've been in this master planning process for about a year, a lot of public input, a lot of community groups that have been involved in it. And, the thing is we want to honor, of course, the things that have been done by the community groups in the past. There's a lot of facilities on the fairgrounds that they've been involved in the past, and the community still wants to see some of those things involved in the property, as well as improve for the future, and provide something that can maybe make the property act as more of a year-round facility.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in just a little bit, but the money then for this first phase, that's how much?
We have budgeted $5 million to do the first phase, and we believe that would cover what is needed in the recommended first phase. So that's where we're at.
Yeah, we had a bunch in the budget for the fair. A lot of that was spent, though, to buy the property, right? So much.
Well, that was done in previous years. last year we bought the Boswell property that is south of the river, north of the river, I should say, and it was property that we were already using for the fair each year under a lease. But now it's under county control, and that's why we did the master plan in the first place. So, yes, there has been some money spent on completing or starting the vision of what the fairgrounds will be in the future.
Mm-hmm. So is the money for this coming just from the county and the transient room tax, or will there be funding from Colville City and the North Summit Recreation District?
Well, I mean, the master plan does contemplate some items that are probably more centered on Colville or North Summit Recreation District, specifically field space or grass space that could accommodate a soccer event or a lacrosse event or something like that, as well as a splash pad. We contemplate getting funding in the future from those organizations. They probably don't have the ability to commit to that today. One of the reasons we're phasing this plan is because that is not available. But, you know, as well as those things come forward, for instance, if Colville City was able to bring forth some significant grant money in the future, that's a trigger point for the county to consider going forward with that amenity on the property.
All right. So even with the planned expansion and the new property, will the fairgrounds need even more expansion?
Well, it's possible. The master plan contemplates expansion of property if there's a desire to do that. I mean, one of the things that was brought up during the citizen comments is that if we move the rodeo portion of the fairgrounds to the north side of the property across the creek, we're going to take up more parking because the plan is to replace that current rodeo grounds with a grass field. So we'll lose parking availability. That might be in a future year something that then is decided to expand the property even further. And there are opportunities for that because there is property available around it that is not built with homes. So don't know what that future is going to be. But one of the reasons you phase a master plan and go into it slowly is so that as conditions change, you can react to that. So there is flexibility within this plan to do that.
All right. And then what about the upgrade for the Chalk Creek corridor?
Well, and that's an important point that was brought up not only by the council but by citizen comments during our last meeting. We have not gone into any further study of that because we don't have the budget to do that right now. But the plan does identify that that is something we need to do. Plus, the phase one that we're suggesting does not preclude doing anything with that stream corridor. So if there was a reason to reroute it or do other improvements to it in order to improve the flood situation, for instance, or to improve it as an amenity for the fairgrounds, I think we can still do that. We're not boxing ourselves out of doing that in our phase one.
All right. At 6 o'clock, a public hearing for a structure that extends into the skyline visible from Chalk Creek Road. The applicant is Denny Wright, represented by Mike Brown. So explain again how the East County Code, different on Hilltop Building, by contrast with the Snyderville Code, looking at a house visible to Interstate 80. I mean, why do you have to decide on whether a house is visible from Chalk Creek Road?
Well, it's a little looser in its definition. If you remember on the Snyderville Basin side, we have places that we need to look at and from certain vantage points in order to decide whether a certain ridgeline is being violated by a home. It's a little different on the east side. It doesn't have those vantage points necessarily identified, so there's a little bit more judgment involved or subjectivity involved. As you know, we're also the council is also contemplating some changes to Chapter 2 in order to be more definitive. And that's still being debated on what the right thing to do is there. But this project has been waiting quite a while to come forward, so the applicant would like a special exception.
All right. And then finally, what's new on the county's efforts for funding Bonanza Flat?
Still working through the paperwork with the city on the exact deal points of that. And it's all still in closed session items. But the commitment is as strong as it has been.
All right. Anything else?
Yes. So the East Side Planning Commission currently has two seats available. And the two people that were coming out of those seats were term limited. So we will have two new members. That application process is open till 5 p.m. on April 4th. So please visit the website, summitcounty.org, and navigate to the place where you can apply. We want as many applicants as possible.
All right. Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 825. Well, you may not have noticed it, but your bill for the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District did go up 3%, starting with your January billing. Impact fees on new construction have also been raised 7%. In the studio to tell us why and how this additional money will be spent, I have District Director Mike Lures. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Leslie.
So how much does that 3% increase bring into the
approximately
district?
Approximately about $300,000 a year.
Okay. Over how many, I guess, what do you call them, just customers?
Yes, we have 14,000 customers in the city and the basin, and the average residential bill is, with the increase, is $40.50 approximately, which is about half of what my water bill is, so we're still pretty good shape when you compare those two.
Okay, so on average, it raised a couple dollars per household.
Actually less, about a dollar, about $1.25.
All right. And then the 7% increase in impact fees seems a bit more onerous. That was done why?
Yeah. If you recall, we have two water reclamation facilities that receive all of the sewage or wastewater generated here in Park City in the Snyderville Basin. One of these facilities is located out kind of north of the Home Depot area along the rail trail. And we are needing to tear this facility down, rebuild it. We'll double the size and upgrade the level of treatment to what we call advanced tertiary treatment to protect our local environment, Silver Creek and East Echo Reservoir in particular. This project, which we actually started about a year and a half ago on design, went into construction about a year ago, and it's a $51 million project, one of the largest public works projects ever to take place that's completely funded with local dollars, and this project will not be completed until the spring of 2020. If you want to see a very large construction project, be glad to take anyone out there to take a look at it. We are currently spending approximately $1.3 million a month on this project. 93% of this project will be paid for by new growth, thus the increase on the impact fees. And 7% will be paid for by current users or user fees, and that's where the 3% goes, in addition to maintaining our current system. So 93% of this particular project is slated to be paid for by new development and 7% by our current users. Now, the reason there's 7% charged to the current users is because we're going to that advanced treatment for all customers, not only the future users, but the current users. And again, that's to protect our local environment.
Yeah, so $300,000 a year from the 3% increase. What do you expect to raise each year then with that 7% increase?
That, in addition to the 7%, it'll go up another 4.3% in the beginning of 2018. And we'll see what that does for us in the way of growth. The issue that we have is you never know when the growth is going to take place, so we are constantly reviewing the financing of this project. We did borrow $22 million in this project, in addition to some money we had in the bank and, of course, these increases. The amount of money that we received in 2016 was about $3 million, so 7% of that is roughly what the increase would be, assuming you have equal amount of growth, and we think we will. Growth is very busy. The cost of these projects is increasing all the time. We bid this out a year ago, and the prices came in about $3 million more than what we had anticipated. The reason for that is because this project takes so long to build that the contractors were concerned about price increases on cement, steel, those type of things between now and the end of 2019. So that's kind of built into the cost. And, you know, that's an additional $3 million we had to factor into the overall financing of this project. In addition to that project, we have a project that will be paid for by current users entirely, and that is rehabilitating the pipeline that collects the wastewater from the east side of the city and the basin and transports the wastewater to the same facility that's located north of the Home Depot area. Rehabilitating that line, just that single line, will be $10 million project, and we'll be starting that this year as well.
Hmm. So the fact that you've raised or could raise impact fees, you know, more than 11% in the last handful of years, I mean, does that send any red flags to folks down at the Utah legislature? I mean, what leeway do you have?
Well, it's very strict on the Utah law is very strict on how you raise impact fees. So we had to go through a very lengthy evaluation of the actual costs that should be allocated to new development. We produce these facility plans, as recalled, and they're submitted to the state. So we went through all the procedures that are necessary to justify these kind of expenditures. With these increases, even at the end of 2018, or you know, I could say at the beginning of 2018, the impact fee will be approximately $8,400 for a residential equivalent, or another way of looking at that is a three-bedroom home. While that's not a cheap impact fee, that's still less than even the local water impact fees.
Okay. Now, the money that we're talking about here, this is all going towards basically capital projects as opposed to staff and operations?
The 7% on the user fees is going towards this project, the $10 million pipeline project, and rehabilitation and maintenance of the overall system. We currently have almost $500 million in current replacement costs in the ground, meaning we have 300 miles of pipeline, we have 7,000 manholes, we have these two treatment facilities, and if you were to replace those today, it would be just shy of $500 million. That's the type of investment that this community has made over the last 30 years. So it takes a lot of money to maintain that system, and there's inflation built in to these rate increases to help maintain the system.
Yeah. Are you starting to see, though, that infrastructure fail?
You know, we've done a very good job, and I really kudos to our staff because we have a very aggressive and proactive program. We try to catch failures before they actually occur, and we've done a good job with that.
Okay. Now, this advanced tertiary treatment that you're talking about, is that something that we would see also take place at the Jeremy Ranch plant?
We upgraded the Jeremy facility in 2003 to advanced treatment where we removed phosphorus and nitrogen, and that's what we're now doing at the Silver Creek facility. I would point out, however, that probably in the late 2020s, not too long from now actually, we will need to expand the Jeremy facility once again, and this is all in response to a growth that's taking place.
Yeah. And in terms of the two plants then, are they big enough to handle projected build-out?
We have an adequate footprint, but at the facility north of Home Depot, or what we call the Silver Creek facility, it's virtually a complete teardown because it was built in 1985. It was never designed to remove nitrogen and phosphorus. So that facility is virtually being torn down as we speak. Keep in mind, we have to operate it while all this is taking place, so it's a rather complex operation. But the East Canyon facility also has a large enough footprint to be expanded. We don't need to go outside our current fence line.
Okay. All right. Let's see, in terms of just things that you worked on during the state legislature, anything there that was noteworthy?
You know, nothing, I guess, that's really out. Unusual. There are always bills that pertain to impact fees and how they must be calculated. So we'll have to see what those final bills say. There's nothing in them that gives us any great heartburn. We'll just have to follow the new rules and regulations. We're okay with them.
Yeah. And in terms of just the great snowfall that we got, water levels should be okay this?
Oh, water levels should be great. You know, as you well know, it's very warm this week. We prefer to see this run off very slowly. We would like to see the flow in East Canyon Creek in Silver Creek as well to kind of increase slowly and stay high through the summer to protect the local fish populations. But I think we have enough snow to be in good shape this year.
Okay. Anything else?
I think that's it, Leslie.
All right, Mike, thanks for your time this
Thank
morning.
Thank you.
That's the director of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, Mike Lourdes. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, as we've reported, Utah will become the first state in the country to lower its legal drunk driving threshold from 0.08% to 0.05% blood alcohol content. While no one wants impaired drivers on our roads, there is concern about how this new law that once signed by the governor would not go into effect until December 30th of 2018, stands to impact our tourism and hospitality industries. On the phone to discuss is Sarah Longwell. She's the manager and director of the American Beverage Institute. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us. Now, this American Beverage Institute based in Washington, D.C., you were telling me?
Yeah, we're in D.C. We're a national restaurant trade association, so we represent hundreds of restaurants across the country, including many in Utah. So we were very concerned about this law, and, you know, I got out there and testified during the hearing, and, you know, I was incredibly surprised to see how much support there was for this. I mean, even in a state like Utah, which obviously has sort of a unique relationship with alcohol.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts of Park City Hospital. We're part of the
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was still very surprised at how quickly this flew through the legislature. And one of the reasons it did is because another D.C. group, the National Transportation Safety Board, kind of targeted Utah and said, look, this is a state where we think we can get this law done. And they've been working on this since 2013 when they first came out and recommended that states go to 0.05. And when they did that, they didn't find a lot of support, not public support, not other support from agencies or government organizations, not even Mothers Against Drunk Driving was willing to get on board. And so since then, they've really focused on how do we get this done in one state? How do we kind of start the national movement by just getting it done in one place? And so they really focused on Utah. And they did get it done. And, you know, I don't know if you're hearing anything different than I am, but at the moment, based on his public comments, it does look like the governor's going to sign it. And that is going to be catastrophic for the hospitality industry, the tourism industry, not to mention the average person who goes out and maybe has a glass of wine with dinner. And now can be subject to arrest.
Well, you say this, of course, as a lobbyist. We should note that this is not a good idea. And of course, you're being paid to say things like that. But you wrote an op-ed for the Salt Lake Tribune saying that Utah lawmakers missed an opportunity to target the real drunk driving problem. What's that missed opportunity?
Well, first of all, just on the lobbyist point, I'll note that I took this job because I wanted to fight absurd laws like this one. It's not that they're paying me to say it. And frankly, you know, all the statistics bear it out. You know, in Utah specifically, the vast majority of alcohol-related fatalities, you know, over 77%, occur at extremely high BACs. We're talking about 0.15 or above. The average BAC for somebody in Utah in a fatal accident is 0.20. So that's more than four times the legal limit that they're proposing. And it's extremely intoxicated. And, you know, this is something that we see all the time. It is these high BAC and repeat offenders, hardcore drunk drivers, those are the people that are causing fatalities on the roadways. And for some reason, groups like the NTSB want to focus on the opposite end of the problem, the place where fatalities are not happening. You know, only 1% of fatalities occur between this sort of disputed 0.05, 0.08 limit. And even then, the National Highway Transportation, NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration doesn't quantify those as alcohol-related because, you know, they're alcohol-involved. There is alcohol, some, you know, a little bit of alcohol in the scene, but even the federal government doesn't say that the alcohol is what caused the accident because the impairment level is so low. You know, you are more impaired driving, talking on a hands-free cell phone, you know, just in your car on your Bluetooth. You're more impaired doing that than you are driving at the 0.08 legal limit, the current legal limit. And so, you know, when you reduce that legal limit by a full 38%, you know, going from 0.08 to 0.05 is almost cutting it in half. You know, the impairment is really not almost non-existent. And Utah was an interesting place for the NTSB to kind of plant its flag because fewer of your residents drink, I think there was less perspective on what 0.05 meant. It was very easy to come in and tell Utahns like, hey, you know, 0.05 is really impaired. And for someone who doesn't drink, they can say, oh, okay, I guess it is. But for people who, you know, routinely have a glass of wine with dinner or something, you know that that level is not an impairing level. And so, you know, and at this point, you might as well reduce it to zero, you know, because you will, it is sort of a de facto ban on drinking, at least for parts of the population. You know, a 120-pound woman can have a single glass of wine, beer, spirits, and be almost at this level at which she would get arrested. And I don't think a whole lot of people are going to roll the dice on that. I mean, I certainly, if I thought I could be subject to arrest for one drink, you know, I'll just forego it altogether. But is that a reasonable law to have? We don't think so.
So the unintended consequences, you think that people either don't go out or people won't drink when they go out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that I think there's a lot of unintended consequences. You know, I think that for starters, people outside the state who might otherwise come there as a tourist, you know, a skier, bring a convention there, will look at Utah and say, you know, they're just going too far with some of these alcohol laws. You know, I don't want to risk getting pulled over if I had a drink at, you know, the ski lodge before heading back to my hotel. I think, you know, that's the first unintended consequence. But then there's the consequence for, you know, the person who doesn't really know if they're over 0.05 or not. They don't feel at all impaired. They get pulled over for, you know, whatever reason, maybe a sobriety checkpoint, and all of a sudden they get a DUI, and they're subjected to fines, you know, at jail time, at ignition interlock, you know, just in just a ton of stuff, and, you know, social stigma, and it can ruin a person's life, a DUI can. And I think we just have to ask ourselves, are we willing to inflict that kind of penalty on someone for behavior that is less dangerous than talking on a hands-free cell phone? Which I think, you know, if you think about that in context, you say, oh, man, I do that all the time. And I also don't feel like I'm being dangerous. In fact, I feel like I'm doing the responsible thing by using my Bluetooth instead of, you know, holding the phone in my hand. And so if you consider that sort of widely conducted behavior to be more or less responsible, then consider that 0.05 is far less impaired than that.
Yes, and you're basing that on that University of Utah study that showed that impairment comes from talking on a cell phone?
Yeah, so I used the Utah study primarily because it was there in Utah, and so people had, you know, context for, oh, I know this university. But many this study has been done and replicated over and over again across the country, and they all find the same thing, that you are more impaired talking on a hands-free cell phone than you are at 0.08, because it's the conversation that is impairing you. It's the your mind sort of being split in what it's doing. Yes, but the University of Utah did do this driver simulation study. It was one of the first people to do it. And incidentally, this is just something that I think people find interesting, because texting is also such a big problem on the roadways. If you're texting, it's the equivalent of being impaired at that 0.20 level, which is, you know, extremely, extremely impaired. And it's the average rate at which somebody dies in a fatality in Utah.
Yeah. I got to ask you, I mean, in terms of the tourism business, I mean, you question why people would choose Utah over Colorado. I mean, and I guess I would say, does that really stick? Because given that skiing is a family sport, I mean, I can see here in Utah that advertising already, you know, it's like, you know, come to the place where there's no pot shops and no drunk drivers. I'm just curious why you think that people would forego Utah powder over somewhere else just because of a decrease in the blood alcohol content percentage.
Well, you know, I think you're coming potentially from a perspective where, you know, alcohol is not a big part of maybe the daily lives of a lot of people who live in Utah, but for the majority of the rest of the country, if they're going to go on vacation, they want to be able to have a drink with dinner. It's part of the big part of the hospitality industry. It's a big part of the tourism industry. And so sort of setting yourself aside, and you're right, it's not going to matter to everybody. But certainly if you're dealing with conventions where you're talking about a lot of grown-ups or film festivals, you know, places where people are looking for a certain kind of event, I do think that people would forego Utah in favor of Montana or Colorado or places where they don't feel like the laws are so oppressive.
I was surprised to hear you say that Mothers Against Drunk Driving did not support the legislation. How come?
Well, our group has been involved on the AC issue for a long time, and so we've done a lot of back and forth with Matt. And during the .08 fight, back when, and Utah was the first state to go to .08 back in 1983, and it took about almost 20 years for the rest of the country to follow, but it did sort of steadily and slowly. And the main catalyst for going to .05 was Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They really had that role of being out there pushing for lowering the legal limit. And when they made that argument compellingly over the course of those 20 years, ever since 1980, they really relied on the science and said, look, the science says .08 is where impairment begins. And so if you look up Mothers Against Drunk Driving in the .08 fight, you see that they just really hammered this point home. .08 is where impairment begins. And the federal law was only passed in 2004. So you're really only talking about 15 years since they sort of insisted that scientifically, .08 is where impairment began. And so it would be very difficult for them to come back now and say, no, it's .05. They don't think the science supports it. they just don't, because the science doesn't support it. I mean, everybody who supports .05 is relying on one very specific scientist, and his name is James Fell. And he's been the primary person over the last 4 years who has been an advocate for, widespread use of ignition interlock technology, for lowering the legal limit, zero tolerance. And he has, he creates these studies that, we would sort of put in the junk science category. And that's who the NTSB is relying on. But most independent scientists would say, yeah, look, this isn't where a reasonable level of impairment begins. The NTSB throws around sort of some flashy numbers. They're like, wow, your impairment is doubled at .05 from nothing. Okay, well, if you're at zero impairment and it's doubled, that's not very meaningful. And so without context, it's easy for people to sort of buy into their numbers. But, you're far more impaired driving in the dark or over the age of 65 or under the age of 25. Or with people in the car talking, there's levels of impairment that we tolerate every day, driving drowsy, that people don't think at all of. And so the question is whether or not this is the level now that we're going to put someone in jail, whether or not we're going to, give them $10,000 fines, put an ignition interlock in their car, create problems with them in terms of employment. It's really about, DUIs are, they're a serious offense in this country. We take drunk driving very seriously. All of us do, and we should. But the thing is, these people aren't drunk, and that's they are in fact sober, which is part of the reason, too, this law is going to be very difficult to enforce. People at .05 don't exhibit any of the drunk driving signs that police officers are trained to go and find. They don't weave on the highway. They would certainly pass a field sobriety test. And so it's just one of these laws that doesn't make much sense, especially when you just look at the numbers and you say, okay, the preponderance of the deaths are over on this side, almost none are over on this side. Why don't we focus on that serious problem? In Utah, very few people who are ordered to get their ignition interlock actually get it. Your compliance rates are very low, the way that they're low across the country. And rather than focusing your resources on saying, hey, for this guy who's had three DUIs, we're going to put an ignition interlock in his car and we're going to leave it there. We're going to make sure he's got it. That would save so many more lives than going after moderate and responsible social drinkers.
All right.
It's about how you deploy resources to save the most lives. This idea that, you're a lobbyist and so you just care about people drinking. I've got kids. I drive on the roads. Nobody wants drunk drivers on the roads. Zero people do. Nobody could be so cynical as to say they wanted drunk drivers on the roads. What you want is good policy. And what's happening in Utah is not good policy. It is a distraction from the real problem, and it criminalizes, responsible adults who've had a glass of wine with dinner. And so it's really about what's good policy versus bad policy, what saves lives versus what makes people feel good.
Okay. Sarah, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning. The Epic Pass isn't the only opportunity for discounted skiing here in Utah. The Mountain Collective is an international alliance of premier ski destination that includes skiing at Alta, Snowbird, and Snow Basin. On the phone with details, I have Christian Knapp. He's the vice president of marketing at Aspen, one more of the resorts that is included in the Mountain Collective Pass. Good morning, Christian.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. So begin by telling us a little bit about the Mountain Collective. It was formed in response to the Epic Pass, or it's been around for a while?
It has been around for a while. We actually started the product in 2012, and so we are in our fifth season, and we've gradually grown over time to include more destinations, and as you mentioned, it's gone global. We have a partner in Australia and a partner in Japan and Chile and France, and so, but the core of the product still remains definitely focused on North America, and we've just launched for 17-18. And we've made some really exciting adjustments to the offering to really benefit Utah skiers and snowboarders. We've got Alta with 2 days available. We've got Snow Basin, which is new, will be new for next year with 2 days available there. And then, of course, Snowbird with 2 days there. And if you buy now, you get a bonus day at a destination of your choice. So if you live in Salt Lake or Park City, you can choose a bonus day at one of those resorts. So you essentially can get up to 7 days of skiing included in your immediate vicinity, and then a drive to, say, Sun Valley or Jackson Hole to get additional days. And if you need days beyond the ones included on the pass, you can buy them at 50% off the window rate, as many as you need. And there's never any blackouts on the product. So it's a really great option for somebody in Utah. And right now the price is $399, and we've got a $1 kids pass as well that can be added to an adult pass for kids under 12.
All right, so
really good value.
How many resorts are we talking about?
We've got 16 destinations now on the pass. So Aspen is considered a destination. We have 4 ski resorts actually separate, but you get 2 days here if you come to visit us.
Okay. And again, we've got like Revelstoke, Sun Valley, you mentioned, Jackson Hole. Where else?
Yeah, we've got some great ones in California as well. Mammoth Mountain, which is more in Southern California, one of the biggest in California, as well as Squaw Valley Alpine Meadows, which are great. We've got a couple offerings up in Canada. We've got Banff and Lake Louise in the Banff region, as well as you mentioned, Revelstoke, which is really an up-and-coming destination with incredible access to not only the most vertical in the North America. It's got great access to heli and cat operations as well. And we've also got Taos down in New Mexico, which is kind of the best of New Mexico. And we recently added a new partner, Sugarbush, back east as well to, you know, because we've seen a nice uptick in our customer base from the New York, Boston, kind of northeast region.
All right. Do people tend to buy this pass in addition to another pass they may purchase at their home resort? Or is this what people use as their, you know, season's pass?
That's a good question. You know, we do research our guests a lot, and I think about 25-30% of our purchasers do buy a pass at another resort. Could be a single mountain resort that they know they're going to go 10, 20, 30 days at, and then they want the ability to travel to Mountain Collective destinations and get those days as add-ons. So but the vast, 70% plus are, this is their only pass.
All right. People have until when to purchase these, and where do they go to get one?
Well, it's always online. All the sales are on mountaincollective.com, so very easy. Right now you can purchase it. We keep it on sale for the majority of the spring here into the summer months. We take a break, and then we'll be back on sale in the fall. But we always the best deal is right now. It's $399. It's going to be the lowest price point that you're going to see all year. We also have the bonus day. So you can pick a home resort and get a third bonus day at that destination. And the price will ratchet up over time as the quantities go out.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Christian, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.